Have you ever wanted something so badly that it started to feel like it was running your life, like you weren't chasing the goal anymore? The goal was chasing you, sitting in your chest, turning every delay into panic, every obstacle into a personal insult, every quiet day into a sign that the universe forgot your name. That feeling is more common than we admit. And it's also the exact moment most people misunderstand the idea of manifestation, because they treat it like a way to control reality, when the deeper truth is almost the opposite. The more you try to squeeze life into your timeline, the more tense you become. And the more tense you become, the more impulsive your decisions get. And then you call the consequences bad luck, even though it was simply anxiety driving. Stoicism doesn't promise magic. It promises something better, clarity. It teaches you how to want things without becoming needy, how to move toward your goals without turning your peace into a hostage, how to work hard without becoming desperate, and how to trust time without becoming passive. And in that sense, Stoicism can feel like manifestation, not because the universe is taking orders, but because when your inner world becomes calmer and cleaner, your outer life starts responding differently. You notice opportunities you used to miss. You stop sabotaging relationships with pressure. You stop making fear-based choices, and you become the kind of person people want to build with. Marcus Aurelius wrote a line that I come back to often because it's simple and almost brutal. The impediment to action advances action. In other words, the obstacle doesn't have to block you. It can shape you, strengthen you, guide you, if you stop fighting reality like it's an enemy. And that single shift, moving from resistance to alignment, changes the entire way you attract outcomes, because you stop leaking energy into panic and start investing it into wise action. So in this episode, I'm going to give you 10 stoic rules that make your life feel magnetic in the only way that truly matters. You become steady, you become clear, you become harder to shake, and you start operating from abundance instead of lack. Not by pretending you don't want things, but by learning how to want without clinging, to act without forcing, to wait without collapsing, to trust without drifting. As you listen, keep one question quietly in the background, because it will make every rule land deeper. What do you want? And how much of your suffering comes from the way you're holding it? All right, let's begin with the first rule, the art of detached desire. 1. The art of detached desire. Have you ever noticed how wanting something can feel pure at first, almost noble, and then, without warning, it turns into a kind of inner pressure, like your mind starts whispering, "If I don't get this, I'm not okay." And suddenly, the desire isn't a desire anymore. It's a demand. That shift is where people accidentally sabotage the very thing they're trying to bring into their life. Because desperation doesn't just feel unpleasant, it changes how you move. It makes you chase too hard, talk too much, settle too fast, cling to the wrong people, accept the wrong deals, and interpret every small delay as rejection. In other words, it doesn't just hurt your mood, it distorts your judgment. Stoicism treats this distortion as a problem of attachment. Epictetus would say, "You're not suffering because of the thing itself. You're suffering because you made it necessary for your peace." The moment you decide, "I need this outcome to be okay," you hand your inner stability to something outside your control. And once your peace is outside your control, you become emotionally negotiable. Life can push you around with a simple, "Not yet." This is where detached desire comes in, and it's not coldness. It's not pretending you don't care. It's caring without clenching. It's saying, "I want this deeply, but my dignity doesn't depend on it. That single sentence changes everything because it keeps your nervous system calm enough to make good decisions. Think of two versions of the same person chasing the same goal. In the first version, they want the outcome, but they're afraid of not getting it, so they rush. They over-message, they over-explain, they over-commit. They try to force certainty out of people and circumstances that can't give it. They read into everything. They become reactive, and reactivity makes them sloppy. In the second version, they still want it, but they're not begging life for it. They're doing the work. They're preparing. They're improving their position. They're patient without being passive. They're ambitious without being desperate. And because they're calmer, they're sharper. They notice what's real. They sense red flags sooner. They walk away faster when something isn't aligned. They don't accept crumbs just to end the anxiety of waiting. That's the practical difference between wanting and needing. And here's the part that might surprise you. This calm version is what people often describe as magnetic. Not because there's mystical energy, but because humans can feel desperation. It leaks through tone, through posture, through decisions, through how quickly you try to lock something down. Calm confidence, on the other hand, communicates abundance. I have options. I can wait. I respect myself. And whether it's relationships, career opportunities, business deals, or creative work, abundance tends to attract better outcomes because it keeps you from making fear-based choices. Marcus Aurelius didn't talk about manifestation, but he talked constantly about not being ruled by what you don't control. He trained himself to focus on what was his mind, his actions, his character. And when you adopt that focus, you stop trying to pull reality toward you with anxiety and start meeting reality with steadiness. Detached desire doesn't mean you stop pursuing. It means you change what you're pursuing. Instead of pursuing the outcome as a way to feel worthy, you pursue the process as a way to become worthy. Instead of pursuing approval, you pursue alignment. Instead of pursuing a guarantee, you pursue growth. And the irony is that this is often when the outcomes arrive more easily, because you've stopped scaring yourself into bad decisions. Now, let's make this usable. Detached desire is a skill, and like any skill, it shows up in moments where your emotions want to take over. The moment you don't get the reply. The moment the opportunity doesn't happen quickly. The moment you feel behind. The moment you see someone else getting what you want, that's where you practice. You practice by separating effort from outcome. You can control effort. You can't control the result on your preferred timeline. You can control preparation. You can't control when life opens the door. You can control how you show up. You can't control how people interpret you. Epictetus would say, focus on what is yours. And the more you do that, the more your desire becomes lighter, because it's no longer carrying the impossible job of guaranteeing your future. Here's the if then that makes this real. If you catch yourself thinking, I need this to happen, then immediately replace it with, I want this and I'm willing to work for it, but I refuse to lose my peace over it. Then do one action that improves your position. One call, one page, one workout, one application, one practice session, something real. Because the fastest way to detach from obsession is to return to action you can control, and then let the rest breathe. Because this is the hidden truth. When you stop gripping, you stop distorting. When you stop distorting, you start seeing clearly. And when you start seeing clearly, you move better. You choose better. You attract better. Not because life is magical, but because you've stopped poisoning your own decisions with desperation. And once you can hold desire lightly, The next step is learning how to become fully present, because the present moment is where your opportunities actually exist, and most people miss them while their mind is stuck in yesterday or obsessed with tomorrow. 2. Present moment magnetism. Have you ever noticed that the best parts of your life rarely happen in the mental movie you play about the future, and they almost never happen in the replay of the past, because life, real life, keeps arriving in one place only, and it's the place we abandon the most, right now. Most people think they're living in the present because their body is here, but their attention is somewhere else. It's in the next message, the next outcome, the next worry, the next comparison, the next fear, the next what if. And that constant mental time travel creates a strange kind of blindness. You might be moving all day, but you're not really seeing. You might be talking, but you're not really listening. You might be working, but you're not really focused. And then people say, nothing is changing, when the truth is that the opportunities are appearing, but the mind is not present enough to recognize them. This is why the present moment becomes magnetic, not in a mystical sense, but in a practical one. When you are fully here, you catch details other people miss. You sense what's actually happening instead of what you fear might happen. You notice timing. You notice tone. You notice patterns. You notice small openings that lead to big outcomes. And that awareness changes what you do next, which changes what happens next. The Stoics treated attention like a form of power. Epictetus made it painfully clear that you don't control the world, but you do control how you meet the world, and the meeting happens in the present. Marcus Aurelius, writing to himself during the pressure of responsibility and conflict, kept returning to the same anchor. Don't scatter your mind. Don't live as if you had 1,000 lives. Be here. Do what is in front of you with excellence and calm. He has a line that captures the spirit of it. Confine yourself to the present, not because the future doesn't matter, but because the future is built only out of present moments handled well. Now, the reason this rule matters for manifesting what you want is simple. Most people sabotage their goals with absence. They're absent when they're learning, so they don't actually learn. They're absent when they're working, so their work stays average. They're absent in relationships, so trust erodes. They're absent in decisions, so they choose from impulse instead of values. And then they wonder why life isn't responding. Life is responding. It's responding to the quality of their attention. Think about the moments that change your trajectory: meeting the right person, noticing the right idea, catching the right opportunity, saying the right sentence at the right time, sensing a red flag early enough to avoid a mistake. Those moments are subtle. They don't announce themselves with fireworks. They appear quietly, and you only see them when you're here. Seneca warned about the way life slips away while we're distracted, and he wasn't speaking as a motivational speaker. He was speaking like someone who watched people waste years while thinking they were merely passing time. Presence is the opposite of wasting time. Presence is the act of treating a moment like it matters, because it does. But let's be honest, being present is not easy in a world designed to fragment you. Your phone is a slot machine for your attention. Your mind is trained to look for novelty. Your nervous system is trained to interpret uncertainty as danger. So, be present can sound like a pretty sentence that collapses when you're stressed. That's why Stoicism gives you something better than slogans. It gives you a practice. Presence begins with reclaiming your attention from the future, not by pretending you don't care about outcomes, but by realizing that obsessing over outcomes doesn't produce them. It produces anxiety, and anxiety produces rushed action, scattered action, or no action at all. So the Stoic move is to bring the mind back to the only place where action is possible. Here's what that looks like in everyday life. It looks like reading a page and actually absorbing it instead of scanning while thinking about something else. It looks like listening to someone and noticing what they're not saying, the hesitation, the emotional meaning behind the words. It looks like working on one task without splitting your attention into 10 tabs, because single tasking is not a productivity trick, it's a respect for reality. It looks like walking into a room and sensing the mood without trying to impress anyone, because you're observing, not performing. It looks like eating without scrolling, not because scrolling is evil, but because you're training the muscle of attention, and attention is the muscle that shapes your life. And presence changes your energy in a way people can feel. When you're present, your words land better because they're not rushed. Your decisions improve because they're not made in panic. Your work gets sharper because it's not diluted. Your relationships deepen because people feel seen. That's what others call magnetism, and it doesn't come from trying to be magnetic. It comes from not being mentally elsewhere. There's a powerful psychological detail here too. Presence reduces neediness. When you're truly present, you're not begging the future to reassure you because you're anchored in what's real. That anchor gives you a quiet confidence. And quiet confidence tends to attract better opportunities because it keeps you from chasing the wrong ones. You stop pushing. You start choosing. So how do you train presence without turning it into a spiritual performance? You start small and mechanical. You use your senses as an anchor. Notice what you can see, hear, feel in your body. Not as a meditation ritual, but as a reset button. You slow down your first breath before you speak. You allow a half-second pause before you respond. You look at the person's face instead of the screen while they're talking. You feel your feet on the ground when you're anxious. These are not poetic gestures. They are practical ways to bring the mind back from its obsession with later. And you choose one present action that builds the future you want. That's the key. Presence without action becomes daydreaming. Action without presence becomes frantic. Stoicism wants the union of both. Calm focus, then the next right step. Let me ask you something that cuts straight through the noise. When you say you want everything, do you actually want everything? Or do you want the feeling you think everything will give you? Security, love, respect, freedom, peace. And if that's what you want, then presence is not optional, because peace can't be postponed. If you can't touch peace in small doses now, the future won't magically deliver it in bulk. Here's the if-then that makes this rule real. If you notice your mind racing ahead, checking, refreshing, worrying, fantasizing, then return to one concrete present task for 10 minutes, fully, and treat those 10 minutes like training for sovereignty. No multitasking, no commentary. Just attention and execution. 10 minutes doesn't sound like much, but it builds a habit that compounds because it teaches your brain that you are the one who decides where attention goes. And over time, you'll see the manifestation effect in a grounded way. You'll catch opportunities sooner. You'll make fewer self-sabotaging decisions. You'll become easier to trust because you're not scattered. You'll create better work because you're actually there while creating it. You'll stop missing life while trying to control life. And once you can return to the present on command, the next rule becomes unavoidable because you'll begin to see resistance differently, not as a sign that you're blocked, but as a teacher shaping you, which is where Stoicism becomes very real, very sharp, and very useful. 3. The wisdom of accepted resistance. Have you ever hit a wall, an obstacle, a delay, a rejection, and immediately felt your mind tighten, like the obstacle wasn't just in your way, it was attacking you, like life was saying no, and that no meant you were unlucky, unseen, or somehow not meant to have what you want? That interpretation is where people bleed power. Because resistance is not always a sign you're blocked. Often it's simply the cost of reality. The world has friction, bodies get tired, projects take longer than you hoped, people hesitate, timing shifts, plans break. And the more you fight the fact that life contains friction, the more suffering you add on top of the work that was already required. Stoicism calls this extra suffering opposition to reality, and it's one of the quiet sources of exhaustion that ruins people, because they don't just deal with the problem, they also deal with the emotional war against the problem. They keep thinking, this shouldn't be happening, and that sentence becomes poison, because it turns every obstacle into a personal injustice. Marcus Aurelius had a different lens, and it's one of the most practical lenses ever written. He said, "The impediment to action advances action. What stands in the way becomes the way." That's not motivational fluff. It's a strategy. It means the obstacle is not separate from your path. It is part of the path, because it reveals what you still need to build: patience, skill, courage, endurance, humility, precision, restraint. Accepted resistance doesn't mean you like the obstacle. It means you stop wasting energy arguing with the fact that it exists. You acknowledge it cleanly, like an engineer. This is the constraint. This is the condition. This is the terrain. And once you do that, your mind becomes quieter, because it's no longer screaming at reality, and that quiet returns your ability to think. This is why acceptance can feel like manifestation in a grounded way. When you accept resistance, you stop making fear-based decisions. You stop rushing into shortcuts. You stop forcing outcomes to relieve anxiety. You stop chasing what isn't ready. You stop abandoning your plan at the first sign of discomfort. You become steady, and steadiness is what allows progress to compound. Epictetus would frame it through control. You don't control whether obstacles appear, but you control your judgment about them, and that judgment determines your next move. If you judge resistance as proof of failure, you'll retreat or panic. If you judge resistance as training, you'll adapt. Same obstacle, different inner story, completely different life. And the most important part is this: resistance often shows you what you actually want. If you quit the moment it gets hard, it was probably a mood, not a mission. That's not an insult. It's clarity. Many people think they want certain outcomes, but what they really want is the fantasy of the outcome without the discomfort of the process. Resistance exposes that fantasy. It forces you to decide whether you want the dream badly enough to accept the cost. Seneca wrote about misfortune as a way that virtue is tested and strengthened, and you can translate that into modern terms. Pressure reveals character, not because pressure is good, but because pressure is honest. It shows you what you've been avoiding. It shows you what you still don't have the skill to handle. It shows you where your mindset collapses. And once you see those weak points, you have something rare: a clear map of what to train. So how do you practice accepted resistance without turning into someone who tolerates everything and never changes anything? You separate acceptance from surrender. Acceptance is acknowledging what's real. Surrender is giving up your agency. Stoicism never asks for surrender. It asks for clear-eyed engagement. If the obstacle is real, you accept it. Then you ask, what is the next controllable step? Not the perfect step, not the dramatic step. The next step you can execute. If it's a rejection, the next step might be improving your skill, refining your approach, trying again with better leverage. If it's a delay, the next step might be preparation, learning, saving, training, building. If it's criticism, the next step might be extracting the useful part without swallowing the insult. If it's a setback, the next step might be rebuilding routine rather than obsessing over the loss. Accepted resistance turns you into a problem solver instead of a complainer, and that shift is powerful because it changes what you do with your energy. People who fight reality spend energy on emotional heat. People who accept reality spend energy on adaptation. And adaptation is what wins. There's also a deeper psychological freedom here. When you accept resistance, you stop seeing your life as a referendum on your worth. You stop treating every obstacle as a message about your identity. You become more like a craftsman, working with materials, adjusting to conditions, making progress through patience and iteration. That mindset is stable. It's hard to break. It's also rare, which is why it creates outcomes most people don't reach. Here's the if, then. If you feel resistance and your first impulse is to panic, complain, or quit, then pause and rename it. Call it training. Call it friction. Call it the price. Then ask one calm question. What is this trying to teach me that will make me stronger? After that, take one action that proves you're still moving. Small, real, immediate. The action is important because it turns acceptance into forward motion, not into passivity. Over time, this rule makes you dangerous in the best sense. You become the person who doesn't collapse when things are hard. You stop needing life to be smooth in order to stay consistent. You stop reading struggle as a sign to stop. You start reading struggle as part of the contract. And once you can accept resistance without losing your center, the next rule becomes natural. You begin to reclaim inner authority because you stop letting external conditions dictate your internal state. And that shift is where calm confidence is born. 4. The power of inner authority. Have you ever had a day where nothing truly terrible happened, yet you still felt thrown off, like a single comment, a delayed reply, a small shift in someone's tone, or one unexpected inconvenience was enough to hijack your mood, and then the rest of the day followed that mood like a shadow? That's the moment you realize something that can sting a little. Your inner state has been outsourced, not to one person, but to the world. Its timing, its opinions, its randomness. And when your peace is outsourced, you're always negotiating with life, always trying to arrange the outside so you can finally feel okay on the inside. The problem is, the outside never stays arranged. It moves, it changes, people change, circumstances drift. So, if your peace depends on external stability, you will rarely feel stable. Stoicism offers a different foundation, inner authority, the ability to decide what kind of person you will be in this moment, regardless of what the moment brings. Epictetus said it plainly, some things are up to you and some things are not. Most people nod at that idea and then live as if everything is up to them. Other people's reactions, outcomes, timing, fairness. Inner authority is when you stop pretending you can command those things and you reclaim the one domain that is actually yours, your judgments, your choices, your standards. Marcus Aurelius practiced this like a daily discipline. He wasn't trying to become emotionally numb. He was trying to become internally governed. He kept reminding himself that the world is full of noise, insults, flattery, and chaos, and that none of it has to become his. Not because he could control the world, but because he could control what kind of mind he carried through the world. That's inner authority. I will not let this event appoint itself as my ruler. Now, why does this matter for manifesting what you want? Because a person without inner authority is easy to pull off course. Their plan is constantly interrupted by feelings. Their habits depend on mood. Their discipline collapses under stress. Their decisions are reactive, and reactive decisions tend to produce reactive lives, unstable, inconsistent, full of unnecessary detours. But when you reclaim inner authority, you start moving through life with a steadiness that creates results. Not because you're forcing the universe, but because you're no longer forcing yourself to live in panic. You become calmer, and calm makes you precise. You become less needy, and less neediness makes you choose better. You become less reactive, and less reactivity keeps you consistent. Inner authority is also the cure for the hidden posture of lack. Lack doesn't always mean you have nothing. Sometimes lack is simply the inner feeling of, I'm not okay until something changes. That feeling makes you chase. It makes you compromise. It makes you accept what you shouldn't accept. It makes you rush decisions just to get relief. And then you wonder why life keeps giving you outcomes that feel beneath you. Life often meets you at the level of what you tolerate and what you repeatedly choose while anxious. So the Stoic move is to stop negotiating with yourself about your worth. You are not a beggar in your own life. You do not need the perfect conditions to behave with dignity. You do not need everyone to approve in order to stay aligned. Inner authority is saying, even here, even now, I can choose my response. This is what separates a calm person from a controlled person. Controlled people look calm only when life is easy. Calm people are calm because they have an internal anchor. And that anchor is built in small moments. It's built when you feel the urge to over-explain, and you don't. It's built when you feel offended and you refuse to react impulsively. It's built when you feel anxious and you choose one useful action instead of doom scrolling. It's built when you don't get the outcome you wanted and you still behave like a person you respect. Seneca talked about the mind as something that must be trained, not something that automatically serves you. And that's exactly what inner authority is. Training. You don't wake up one day and suddenly feel unshakable. You become unshakable by repeatedly choosing your standard over your emotion. Not suppressing emotion, choosing over it. Now, there's a subtle danger here. Some people hear inner authority and think it means they should ignore feedback, become rigid, or act like they don't care. That's not authority, that's defense. Inner authority is flexible. It's strong enough to listen, strong enough to adjust, strong enough to admit mistakes, but stable enough that it doesn't collapse under judgment. It's the ability to say, maybe they're right, without losing your self-respect. And also the ability to say, they're wrong, without needing to punish them for it. That balance is power. So how do you practice inner authority in a way that changes your life? You start by noticing when your mood is being dictated from outside. When you feel yourself rising or falling based on someone's reaction, ask a simple question. Who is in charge of me right now? That question is not philosophical. It's diagnostic. If the answer is this person, this situation, this delay, this comment, then you've found the moment to reclaim authority, and you reclaim it by returning to your values, not your feelings. Values are stable. Feelings are weather. Ask, what would the version of me I respect do next? That question is the bridge between stoicism and action. Here's the if-then that makes it practical. If something external triggers you, criticism, delay, rejection, disrespect, then pause and choose one response that protects your dignity, not your ego. That might mean stepping back and not replying. It might mean speaking briefly and clearly. It might mean returning to your work instead of trying to win an argument. It might mean accepting what you can't control and adjusting your next step. The key is that you do not let the trigger dictate the next chapter of your day. And over time, something changes inside you that is hard to describe until you've lived it. You stop feeling like life is happening to you, and you start feeling like you are meeting life with command. That's inner authority. And once you have it, the next rule becomes almost obvious, because you stop confusing frantic activity with progress, and you start understanding the strange power of strategic non-action, knowing when to move and knowing when to wait without anxiety. 5. The art of strategic non-action. Have you ever pushed so hard for an outcome that you could feel your mind overheating, like every hour of waiting became unbearable, like silence from the world felt like rejection, and then, because you couldn't tolerate the uncertainty, you acted too soon, said too much, chose the wrong thing, and later realized the real mistake wasn't the obstacle, it was the impatience. This is one of the strangest truths about building a life you actually want. Sometimes effort is not the missing ingredient. Sometimes the missing ingredient is restraint. Not the kind that quits, but the kind that knows when forcing becomes self-sabotage. Modern culture worships movement. If you're not constantly doing something, it feels like you're falling behind. And that pressure creates a very specific kind of suffering. Busy anxiety. You take action not because it's the right action, but because action gives you temporary relief. It makes you feel in control. It quiets the fear for a moment. But relief-driven action is usually sloppy action. It's action that leaks dignity, leaks leverage, leaks clarity, and later you pay the price. Stoicism calls you back to something calmer. The discipline of timing. Epictetus gave students a simple rule that sounds almost too plain to matter, but it changes everything when you actually live it. Focus on what is yours. Your effort is yours. Your judgment is yours. Your character is yours. Outcomes and timing are not fully yours. Strategic non-action begins right there, because once you accept that timing isn't something you can bully, you stop trying to squeeze certainty out of life with frantic movement. Marcus Aurelius practiced this in a world where he could have easily mistaken constant activity for leadership. Yet you can feel him trying to stay clean inside, trying to act when action is needed, and to refuse action when action would be ego, impulse, or fear. There's a stoic strength in holding your position without panic. It's not indecision, it's command. And this is where manifestation becomes practical rather than mystical. People often talk about the universe as if it's a vending machine, but the deeper reality is simpler. When you stop forcing, you stop distorting. You stop sending desperate signals. You stop making choices that come from fear of waiting. You become easier to trust. You become clearer to work with. You become more accurate in your next move. And accuracy beats intensity almost every time. Strategic non-action is the skill of not interfering with your own progress. Because a lot of interference looks like effort. It looks like over-messaging, over-correcting, over-explaining, over-chasing, over-committing. It looks like sending one more text to clarify, making one more offer to lock it in, checking one more time to make sure. But underneath those behaviors is usually one emotion, anxious attachment to an outcome. Stoicism doesn't ask you to stop caring about outcomes. It asks you to stop being owned by them. Seneca has a way of exposing the hidden cost of constant motion. He warns that scattering yourself makes you weaker, not stronger, because your energy gets divided into tiny pieces and you start living reactively. He even says, in essence, that being everywhere is being nowhere, and if you've ever tried to build a meaningful life while your attention is constantly jumping, you know how true that feels. Strategic non-action is how you stop scattering. It's how you stop turning your life into a set of frantic micro-reactions. Now, let's make this concrete, because otherwise waiting can sound like an excuse. Strategic non-action is not doing nothing. It's choosing the kind of action that is invisible, preparing, observing, strengthening, becoming. It's the quiet work of removing desperation from your system so that when the moment comes, you don't fumble it. Sometimes the right move is to stop talking and keep building. Sometimes the right move is to let someone reveal themselves without you pushing for a label, a commitment, a reassurance. Sometimes the right move is to let a situation unfold one more day so you can see what's real, rather than forcing an answer that makes you feel safe. Sometimes the right move is to pause before responding, not because you're afraid, but because you respect the power of timing. This is the Stoic idea of self-command in its most practical form. You don't let discomfort force your hand, because discomfort is not always a sign to act. Often, it's just the nervous system demanding certainty. And if you obey that demand every time, you train yourself into impatience. You train yourself to break your own standards just to make uncertainty go away. That's how people end up accepting less than they deserve, choosing shortcuts that cost them later, and calling it fate. So here's a question that cuts through the noise. Are you taking action because it's aligned, or because you're trying to escape the feeling of waiting? When you answer that honestly, your life gets cleaner. And once your life gets cleaner, you start seeing that waiting can be powerful when it's paired with readiness. A hunter doesn't run at every sound. A craftsman doesn't rush the material. A disciplined mind doesn't chase every impulse. This isn't romantic. It's intelligent. Here's the if-then that makes this rule usable today. If you feel urgency rising and you're about to push, chase, or force an outcome, then pause and ask, will this action improve the situation or only soothe my anxiety? If it only soothes anxiety, don't do it. Instead, do one quiet action that strengthens your position. Train, study, refine, save, organize, rest, think. Anything that increases readiness without pressuring reality to move faster. That is strategic non-action. Not surrender, not laziness, but restraint with direction. And over time, this rule changes your life in a way you can actually feel. You become less desperate. You become less reactive. You become more selective. You stop grabbing at life. You start meeting life with calm preparation. And it's hard to describe how attractive that becomes, not just to people, but to opportunities, because you stop looking like someone who needs saving, and you start looking like someone who can build. And once you can wait without panic, the next rule becomes natural, because your mind shifts from scarcity to steadiness, and that's where gratitude stops being a cute idea and starts becoming a force that changes how you see and what you notice every single day. 6. Gratitude as a manifesting force. Have you ever reached a goal you swore would finally make you feel satisfied, and then, almost immediately, your mind moved the finish line, as if enough was always one step ahead of you, always slightly out of reach, like you were drinking from a cup that never truly fills? That restless feeling is the signature of scarcity, and scarcity is not only about money or circumstances, it's a mental posture, a way of scanning life for what's missing, what's late, what's unfair, what's not happening yet. And when you live in that posture long enough, you start interpreting the world through hunger instead of through clarity. You don't just want something. You need it to fix you. You need it to rescue your mood. You need it to justify your patience. And that need quietly turns you into someone who can't see what's already working, which means you can't build on it, because you don't even recognize it as a foundation. This is where gratitude becomes powerful, but not as a cute ritual or a forced smile, and not as a way to pretend everything is fine. In Stoic terms, gratitude is a discipline of perception, the ability to see reality without the fog of entitlement, to recognize what is already good and already yours, so your mind stops acting like it's under constant threat. Seneca touches this when he warns that we are often ungrateful, not because we're evil, but because we're inattentive, because we become so focused on what we don't have that we forget how much we've already survived, already learned, already earned, already been given by life, time, breath, a working body, a chance to improve, a mind that can still choose. And the reason this matters for manifesting is simple. Your perception shapes your behavior, and your behavior shapes your outcomes. A mind trained to notice lack becomes impatient, suspicious, and overly reactive. It interprets neutral events as threats. It overcorrects. It chases validation. It forces timing. It settles out of fear. And then it calls the consequences bad luck. A mind trained in gratitude becomes steadier, more patient, and more accurate because it no longer treats every delay as a disaster or every obstacle as rejection. It treats life as workable, and that mindset produces better decisions, and better decisions are what actually create the results. People call manifestation. Marcus Aurelius had a way of appreciating things without becoming sentimental, and that's the tone you want here. He didn't deny hardship, but he still practiced reverence for what remained, the ability to act with virtue, the chance to improve, the presence of people who mattered, the gift of another day to do the work. That kind of gratitude doesn't make you soft, it makes you stable. It takes you out of the emotional posture of begging and puts you into the posture of building, because you stop acting like life owes you a perfect timeline and you start acting like life is offering you a series of moments you can use well. There's also a psychological truth hiding under this rule. What you repeatedly notice becomes your reality. If you keep noticing what's wrong, your nervous system stays on guard. Your body stays tense, your mind stays impatient, and you move through the world like you're bracing for impact. But if you train yourself to notice what's working, what's improving, what's still available, what's still strong, your mind becomes less chaotic, your attention becomes less scattered, and you start seeing opportunities that were always there but were invisible to a mind obsessed with missing pieces. That's not mysticism. That's how attention works. Gratitude is a way of steering attention toward what strengthens you instead of what drains you. And this is important. Gratitude doesn't mean you stop wanting more. Stoicism never tells you to abandon ambition. It tells you to remove desperation from ambition, because desperation makes you sloppy and gratitude makes you precise. You can want more money, more success, a better relationship, a stronger body, a freer life, and still appreciate the foundation you're standing on right now. In fact, if you can't appreciate the foundation, you'll treat every new level as another place to feel behind. And that mindset is exhausting, and exhaustion is the enemy of consistent action. So the practice here is not to sit around saying thank you while doing nothing. The practice is to stop living as if you're cursed. It's to stop speaking to yourself like you're unlucky. It's to stop treating life as a scoreboard where you're always losing. Because when you treat life like that, you become bitter, And bitterness makes you repel help, repel patience, repel collaboration, repel joy. And then you wonder why everything feels heavy. Gratitude lightens you, and when you're lighter, you move better. You show up differently in conversations because you're not demanding people to fill your emptiness. You become easier to be around, not because you're performing positivity, but because you're not constantly broadcasting need. You negotiate better because you're not negotiating from fear. You create better because your mind isn't clenched. You recover faster because you don't interpret setbacks as proof that you're doomed. Even your discipline becomes easier because discipline collapses when you feel like nothing is working. And discipline strengthens when you can see that something is working and you can build on it. Seneca also had a fierce clarity about this. Much of our suffering comes from wanting life to be different from what it is right now. And there's a place for striving, but there's also a place for acceptance, because acceptance is what keeps your mind from burning out while you pursue what's next. Gratitude is acceptance with warmth. It's the ability to say, I'm building, and I'm also not blind to what I already have. That is not weakness. That is sanity. So how do you turn this into something you can actually use today? You keep it grounded. You don't force emotions. You don't pretend. You simply identify something real that you can respect. A body part that works. A friend who stayed. A habit you've improved, a mistake you didn't repeat, a chance to start again. The fact that you can think, choose, and act. Many people lose that ability, and the Stoics never forgot how fragile life is. When you remember fragility, gratitude stops being a personality trait and becomes a form of humility. Here's the if-then for this rule. If you catch yourself spiraling into it's not enough or it's not happening fast enough, then pause and name three specific things that are already supporting your life right now, and immediately follow that by one action that honors those supports, one disciplined step that builds on what you have instead of cursing what you lack. Because gratitude without action becomes a lullaby, but gratitude with action becomes momentum, and momentum is what changes outcomes. And once gratitude becomes your baseline, you stop chasing your desires like a hungry person chasing crumbs, and you start pursuing them like a grounded person building a life, which leads directly into the next rule. Emotional sovereignty. Because even with gratitude, emotions will rise, and the question becomes whether you can feel them without letting them drive. 7. The strength of emotional sovereignty. Have you ever looked back at a choice you made and thought, that wasn't even me? Not because you lost your values, but because your emotions grabbed the steering wheel for a few minutes, and in those few minutes, you said the thing you can't unsay. You sent the message you can't pull back. You agreed to something you didn't mean. You burned a bridge you actually needed, and then you spent the next week living inside the consequences. That's the price of emotional captivity, and it's one of the main reasons people feel like life is random. Because when your emotions run your decisions, your life starts to look like a storm you can't predict. Stoicism doesn't teach you to stop feeling. It teaches you something far more realistic. Feel everything, but don't surrender your authority to the feeling. That's what emotional sovereignty is. It's the quiet strength of being able to experience anger, fear, desire, envy, excitement, disappointment, fully, without turning any of those states into a command you must obey. Epictetus said it in a way that still slices through modern confusion. Men are disturbed not by things, but by the views which they take of them. The disturbance isn't only the event, it's the meaning your mind assigns in the first second. The story, your nervous system writes without asking your permission. Emotional sovereignty begins right there, because the moment you realize your interpretation is involved, you reclaim options. You might still feel the wave, but you don't have to become the wave. And this matters deeply if you're talking about attracting the life you want, because most people don't fail due to lack of desire. They fail due to emotional leakage. They leak energy into resentment, into anxious overthinking, into reactive texting, into impulse spending, into conflict, into comparison, into quitting too early, into forcing timing, into dramatic decisions made just to end discomfort. Then they call it fate. But it wasn't fate. It was a temporary emotion treated like a permanent truth. Marcus Aurelius kept reminding himself that the mind can step back, that it can create space, that it can choose a response instead of becoming a reflex. He wasn't writing those reminders because he was naturally calm. He was writing them because he was human, surrounded by pressure, surrounded by provocation, surrounded by uncertainty. And he knew the greatest threat to a person with responsibility is not the enemy outside, it's the undisciplined reaction inside. Emotional sovereignty is what keeps you from becoming easy to manipulate, because manipulation works best on people who are predictable in their triggers. Here's the hard reality. If someone can reliably make you angry, they can move you. If someone can reliably make you insecure, they can steer you. If circumstances can reliably make you panic, your decisions will always bend toward relief instead of wisdom. So the goal is not to control your emotions like a robot. The goal is to build a pause, small but real, between feeling and acting, because that pause is where your dignity lives. You can feel jealousy and still choose patience. You can feel anger and still choose silence. You can feel fear and still choose the next brave step. You can feel the craving and still choose the long-term plan. That's sovereignty. It's not suppression, it's command. And if you listen closely, you'll notice something. The people who seem lucky often aren't lucky in the mystical sense. They're emotionally steady enough to stay consistent. They don't torch opportunities because they felt impatient for one day. They don't ruin relationships because they felt insecure for one hour. They don't abandon the work because they felt discouraged for one week. Their feelings change, but their standards don't move as easily. Over time, that stability looks like magnetism, because while others are swinging between extremes, they're quietly building. So how do you actually practice emotional sovereignty in a way that changes outcomes? You stop treating emotion as a judge. You start treating it as information. Anger might be telling you a boundary matters. Fear might be telling you you're entering something meaningful. Sadness might be telling you you need rest or truth. Desire might be telling you what you value. But information is not instruction. Your job is to receive the signal without letting it dictate the decision. That's why the simplest practice is also the most powerful. Delay the reaction. Not forever, just long enough to remove regret. When the emotional heat rises, you don't need a perfect technique. You need a small rule that protects your future self. You can even make it painfully practical. You don't reply while your chest is tight. You don't commit while you're euphoric. You don't decide while you're panicking. You don't argue while you're insulted. You wait until your mind is back in the room, and you'll notice something strange. Most urgent emotions aren't urgent at all. They're loud. They feel urgent because they want immediate discharge. But if you give them a little time, they soften, and in that softness you can finally see the real situation instead of the emotional hallucination of the situation. Here's the if-then for this rule. If you feel a strong emotion rising and you're about to act, speak, or decide, then pause and ask, what would this emotion have me do right now? And what would I choose if I cared about my life a month from now? Then take the smallest action that serves the month from now version of you, not the dramatic action, the clean one, the disciplined one, the one you won't regret. Because emotional sovereignty is not built in grand moments. It's built in ordinary moments where you could have reacted and you didn't. It's built when you let a wave pass without letting it smash your standards. And after enough of those moments, you start living differently, because you're no longer being dragged through your own life by feelings that change every hour. And once your emotions stop owning you, another shift becomes possible. You stop craving endless more, because you begin to feel the quiet richness of enough, which is where the next rule takes you. 8. The philosophy of enough. Have you ever gotten something you wanted? Money, attention, progress, a new relationship, a new level, and instead of feeling settled, you felt a strange hunger open up, like it wasn't relief. It was a new appetite. And now, your mind started demanding more, faster, bigger, louder, as if peace was always one upgrade away. That hunger is not ambition, it's insecurity dressed as ambition. And it's one of the most exhausting engines a person can live with, because it turns life into a permanent chase. Even when you win, you're still running. Even when things improve, you're still dissatisfied. And the tragedy is that you can build a lot while living that way and still feel poor inside. Stoicism offers a radical correction. The richest person is not the one who has the most, but the one who needs the least. This idea goes all the way back to the older roots of Stoic thought and is echoed with painful clarity by Seneca, who wrote aboutly about how poverty is often a matter of desire, not possession. In plain terms, you can be wealthy and still feel desperate if your wants multiply faster than your gains, and you can have modest means and still feel strong if your wants are disciplined. Now, why is enough connected to getting what you want? Because neediness corrupts choice. When you don't feel enough inside, you chase outcomes to repair the feeling. You say yes when you should say no. You settle for the wrong people. You accept deals that don't respect you. You rush your timing. You compromise your values. You cling to situations that are clearly misaligned, because you're not just trying to achieve. You're trying to soothe that quiet fear that says, if I don't get this, I'm not okay. The moment you develop the philosophy of enough, that fear weakens. And as the fear weakens, your standards rise naturally. You stop grabbing, you start choosing, and choosing is what creates a better life. This is one of the most paradoxical manifestation truths. When you stop acting like you're starving, you stop accepting crumbs. When you stop accepting crumbs, your life changes direction, because your decisions become cleaner. You don't waste time on what you know you don't want. You don't cling to what doesn't fit. You don't trade dignity for quick relief. Marcus Aurelius would call this returning to what is sufficient. He trained himself to see how little a person actually needs to live with honor: basic food, basic shelter, a disciplined mind, a clear conscience, and the willingness to do what is right. That doesn't mean he rejected success. It means he refused to make success his identity. He refused to make external gain the source of internal stability. And that is the core of enough. You stop making external things the foundation of your inner life. Because external things can be taken, delayed, changed, misunderstood. But your inner standard, what you tolerate, what you respect, what you choose, that can be stable. The philosophy of enough is also a cure for comparison, which is one of the biggest sources of suffering today. Comparison makes you feel behind, even when you're improving. It makes you feel poor, even when you're building. It makes you feel late, even when you're on time for your life. And the more you compare, the more your desires become infected. You stop wanting what you truly want, and you start wanting what looks impressive in someone else's story. That kind of wanting is endless, because the internet is an infinite showcase, and there will always be someone ahead in one category. Enough breaks the spell. It helps you ask a different question. What actually fits my life? Not what looks good, not what wins applause, not what proves something, but what genuinely supports your peace, your health, your purpose, your relationships, your daily rhythm. And once you can answer that, your wants become simpler, more focused, more real. You stop chasing 10 things with weak energy and start building one or two things with strong energy. That concentration creates results. And results are what people mistakenly think come from luck, when they actually come from clarity. Now, let's ground this in something you can feel. When you don't have enough inside, you're easily shaken. You need constant reassurance. You need constant progress to calm your nervous system. You need constant external proof that you're okay. That's why delays feel so painful. That's why rejection feels personal. That's why you overreact to small things, because the mind is living as if it's in danger. But when you cultivate enough, when you can genuinely say, "I'm okay, even if this takes time," you become harder to manipulate, harder to pressure, harder to rush. Your patience becomes real patience, not forced patience. And real patience is powerful, because patience allows timing to work for you instead of against you. Seneca had a way of making this almost blunt. Much of our misery comes from wanting what we don't need. So the Stoic practice is not to kill desire, but to refine it, to simplify it, to remove the extra wants that exist only to impress others or to soothe insecurity. When you remove those extra wants, your attention returns to what truly matters and your life becomes less chaotic. So how do you practice enough without turning into someone who stops trying? You practice it by separating contentment from complacency. Contentment means you appreciate what you have and you don't feel desperate. Complacency means you stop growing and you stop doing the work. Stoicism wants contentment with effort, gratitude for what is, plus action toward what should be improved. You can be grateful and still ambitious. In fact, gratitude and enough often make ambition healthier, because ambition stops being a compensation for insecurity and starts being an expression of purpose. Here's the if-then for this rule. If you catch yourself feeling desperate, comparing, or rushing, then pause and ask, "What do I already have that is genuinely enough for today?" Name it, feel it, then ask, "What is one desire I can let go of right now that is not actually mine? A desire that came from comparison, pressure, or fear." Release that desire, even for the rest of the day, and watch how your mind quiets. From that quieter place, take one action toward what you truly want, not what you're trying to prove. Because when you live from enough, you become more selective, more grounded, more authentic, and that authenticity becomes the next rule, because manifestation gets blocked the moment you start living a false version of yourself to earn approval. 9. The courage of authentic expression. Have you ever felt the quiet exhaustion of trying to be the right version of yourself for different rooms, different people, different expectations? Like you're constantly adjusting your tone, your opinions, your personality, even your dreams, and then you wonder why what you want feels just out of reach, as if life can't quite find you. There's a grounded reason for that. When you live in performance, you don't move through the world as a clear signal. You move as a shifting one, and a shifting signal creates shifting results. Because people can't trust what keeps changing, you can't commit to what keeps changing. And most importantly, you can't build a life that fits you if you keep editing yourself to fit the room. That's not manifestation in a mystical sense. It's alignment in the most practical sense. The more you hide your real values, the more your choices drift away from your real life, and then you end up working hard for outcomes that don't actually satisfy you, because they were built for the version of you that was trying to be approved of. Stoicism is often misunderstood as a philosophy of suppression, but at its heart, it's a philosophy of truth. Truth in thought, truth in action, truth in speech. Marcus Aurelius wrote a line that feels like a clean knife. If it is not right, do not do it. If it is not true, do not say it. That's not just moral advice, it's a strategy for building a stable identity. Because when your words and actions match what you truly believe, you stop leaking energy into inner conflict. You stop living with that low-level tension of pretending. You stop waking up with a mind that has to remember which mask you wore yesterday. And that inner conflict is more expensive than people realize. It doesn't just hurt emotionally, it breaks decision-making. When you're not being authentic, you're constantly negotiating. Should I say this? Should I hide that? Should I agree? Should I laugh? Should I chase? Should I pretend I don't care? Should I pretend I do? And all of that negotiation drains the very thing you need to build the life you want: clear attention. This is why authenticity requires courage. Because the moment you stop performing, you risk something. You risk being misunderstood. You risk being disliked. You risk not fitting where you used to fit. And that's exactly why most people avoid it. They trade truth for belonging. They trade clarity for comfort. They trade their real preferences for applause. But the Stoics would ask a harder question, one that changes everything. Which is more painful, being disliked by some people or being divided inside yourself? Epictetus was brutally honest about this. He warned that the pursuit of approval is a form of slavery, because the moment you need other people to like you, you start living for their reactions. And he offered a line that's almost like a permission slip for authenticity. If you want to improve, be content to be thought foolish and stupid. He's not telling you to be reckless or arrogant. He's telling you that growth has a social cost, because when you change your standards, the people who benefited from your old standards will resist. When you become clearer, the people who liked you confused will complain. When you become more honest, the people who used your silence will call you difficult. That's not a sign you're doing something wrong. It's often a sign you stopped being easy to control. Now, authentic expression doesn't mean saying everything you think. It doesn't mean oversharing. It doesn't mean turning your life into a confession. In fact, Stoicism respects restraint. Authentic expression is about congruence, not volume. It means when you speak from your true center. And when you act from your true values. And you stop betraying yourself in small ways that accumulate into a life that doesn't feel like yours. You can feel the difference in everyday moments. Someone pressures you to agree with a plan you don't want, and the old you says yes to avoid tension, then resents it later. The authentic you says calmly, "That doesn't work for me," and lets the discomfort pass without trying to rescue everyone's feelings. Someone asks you what you want, and instead of answering with what sounds impressive, you answer with what's true. Someone offers you an opportunity that looks good on paper, but violates your standards, and you turn it down without a long speech, because your values are not negotiable. And here's the paradox. The more you live like this, the more the right things start finding you, not because you're casting spells, but because you've stopped sending mixed signals. You become easier to collaborate with because people know where you stand. You become more respected because you don't fold under pressure. You become more satisfied because your wins are real wins, not trophies for a persona. Let me ask you a question that's worth sitting with for a moment. When you imagine the life you want, do you want the life, or do you want the validation you think that life will bring you? Because if it's mostly validation, authenticity will always feel threatening. And if it's genuinely the life, authenticity will start to feel like relief, because it ends the inner acting. Seneca had a sharp way of describing what happens when you live for appearances. You become busy pleasing others and forget to live. Authentic expression brings you back to living, because it reduces the mental noise of trying to manage perception. It frees up energy for the only thing that truly changes your life: consistent action in the direction of your real values. Here's the if-then for this rule. If you catch yourself about to perform, about to say what sounds acceptable instead of what's true, about to agree to avoid discomfort, about to pretend you don't care when you do, or pretend you care when you don't, then pause and choose the simplest, honest response you can live with tomorrow. Not the most dramatic truth, not the harshest truth, just the clean one. And if speaking isn't necessary, let your behavior be the truth instead. Act in alignment, quietly, and let that alignment do the talking. Because authenticity isn't a personality style, it's self-respect made visible. And once you stop betraying yourself in small ways, you start trusting yourself in big ways, which leads directly into the final rule: trusting timing without drifting, so you can keep moving with patience instead of panic. 10. Trust in divine timing. Have you ever felt the pressure of time so intensely that it didn't just motivate you, it started to poison you, like every delay felt like a threat, every not yet felt like rejection, and every slow season felt like proof that you're falling behind, even if you're still moving? That pressure is one of the most common ways people lose their peace and sabotage their path, because impatience doesn't stay in your head as a thought. It spreads into your behavior as a force. It makes you rush people. It makes you force conversations that should unfold naturally. It makes you take deals that aren't ready. It makes you chase what isn't aligned. It makes you cling to timelines instead of building the capacity to handle the outcome when it arrives. And the painful irony is that the moment you try to force timing, you often create the very delays you were afraid of, because forced choices tend to come with hidden costs. Stoicism offers a different relationship with time, one that doesn't remove ambition, but removes panic. The Stoics didn't talk about divine timing in the modern sense, but they did speak about nature, providence, and the order of things. And they trained themselves to cooperate with reality instead of arguing with it. Marcus Aurelius has that calm, almost surgical reminder: accept the things to which fate binds you, and love the people with whom fate brings you together. The point isn't passive surrender. The point is alignment with what is actually happening, so you can respond wisely instead of emotionally. Because here's the truth most people don't want to face: you can control effort, but you cannot fully control timing. You can plant, you can water, you can prune, you can protect, but you cannot command the season. And when you try to command the season, you don't become powerful, you become anxious. You become the kind of person who can't wait without suffering, and that suffering makes you grab at shortcuts. Trusting timing is not a spiritual decoration. It's a practical discipline, the discipline of continuing to do the right work while refusing to let uncertainty turn you into a weaker version of yourself. Epictetus would bring it back to the cleanest line possible. Focus on what is yours. Your choices are yours. Your integrity is yours. Your patience is yours. Your preparation is yours. But outcomes have dependencies. Other people's decisions, market conditions, health, timing, randomness. And if you demand control over all dependencies, you will live in constant tension. Trust in timing is how you step out of that tension without stepping out of action. And this matters more than people realize, because impatience is not just wanting things faster. Impatience is often a hidden belief that you are unsafe until something happens. It's the nervous system saying, "I can't relax until I get the proof." And when you live that way, you turn your life into a waiting room where peace is always postponed. Stoicism doesn't let you postpone peace forever. It asks you to build peace as a skill while you pursue what you want, so you don't arrive at your goal emotionally bankrupt. Let me ask you something that might sting, but it's worth asking. Are you in a hurry because the goal matters, or because you're trying to escape the feeling of uncertainty? Because those are not the same thing. A goal can matter deeply and still not require panic. In fact, the more a goal matters, the more you should protect your mind from panic, because panic makes you sloppy, and sloppy is expensive. Seneca wrote about how we suffer more in imagination than in reality, and nowhere is that more obvious than in timing. We imagine disasters in every delay. We imagine humiliation in every slow period. We imagine doors closing forever when sometimes a door is simply not open yet. The mind creates a catastrophe story, and then we react to the story instead of reacting to reality. Trusting timing is how you stop obeying the catastrophe story. Now, trusting timing doesn't mean you sit back and wait for miracles. The Stoic version of trust is active. It looks like this. You keep showing up. You keep refining your craft. You keep strengthening your body. You keep cleaning your habits. You keep making courageous moves when the move is yours to make. And you stop demanding that life reward you immediately for the effort. You stop treating the timeline like a verdict on your worth. Because delays can be teachers, and sometimes they're protectors. Sometimes what you think you want would break you if it arrived before you were ready. Sometimes the relationship you're rushing into would have revealed its cost later, but the delay spared you. Sometimes the success you're begging for would have expanded your life faster than your character, and then the success becomes the trap. This isn't superstition. It's a sober recognition that readiness matters as much as desire. Marcus Aurelius lived with the awareness of mortality, which makes timing even more intense, because you know time is limited. But that awareness didn't make him frantic. It made him focused. He didn't say, "Rush." He said, in essence, "Use the day." That's the balance, urgency without panic. You act with intention, but you don't poison your mind with impatience. So what does this look like when you're actually living your life? It looks like doing your part fully, then releasing the rest. Not in a vague way, but in a disciplined way. You send the application, then you stop obsessing over the reply and continue improving your skills. You build the business, then you stop refreshing the metrics as if refreshing is a strategy and return to the work that moves the needle. You show up honestly in relationships, then you stop trying to force certainty out of someone and let time reveal what's real. You keep training, then you stop trying to feel motivated every day and simply become consistent. And in the middle of this, there's a deeper gift. Trusting timing makes you calmer to be around. People can sense when you're trying to squeeze something out of them. Love, reassurance, agreement, commitment, approval. Because pressure has a smell. When you trust timing, you remove the pressure, and that often makes the right things come closer, because you're not gripping them like a lifeline. You're meeting them like a steady person who will be fine either way. Here's the if-then for this final rule. If you catch yourself spiraling in impatience, checking, chasing, forcing, bargaining, then return to one controllable action that increases readiness and set a boundary around your mind by refusing to reopen the question for a fixed period of time. In other words, do the work, then let it breathe. If you've already done what's yours to do today, then the most stoic move is to stop interfering and allow time to do what only time can do. Because when you trust timing, you don't become passive. You become powerful in a quieter way. You stop trading your peace for speed. You stop sacrificing your standards to escape uncertainty. You stop forcing outcomes that aren't ready. You keep moving, but you move clean. And when you move clean long enough, you start to notice something that feels almost like a secret. What's meant for you doesn't need you to panic to arrive. It needs you to be prepared when it does. Before we close, I want you to take a breath and notice what just happened across these 10 rules, because this wasn't really about getting everything you want in the way people usually mean it, like life is a machine. You can hack with the right mindset. It was about becoming the kind of person who stops ruining what they want with panic. And that is a deeper kind of power, because it's not dependent on luck, timing, or other people's moods. When you practice detached desire, you keep your dignity intact while you pursue what matters. So you stop chasing outcomes like a starving person and start moving like someone with standards. When you return to the present, you stop living in mental time travel and you begin to see what's actually in front of you. Opportunities, patterns, red flags, openings, things you can't see when your attention is scattered. When you accept resistance, you stop interpreting friction as rejection and start using it as training, so obstacles don't break your rhythm, they sharpen it. When you reclaim inner authority, you stop outsourcing your peace and you become steady enough to make decisions from values rather than from emotion. When you learn strategic non-action, you stop forcing timing out of fear and you begin to respect the power of waiting with readiness, which protects you from rushed mistakes. When gratitude becomes discipline, you stop living from lack and you start building from stability, because you can finally recognize what's already working and you can build on it. When you develop emotional sovereignty, your feelings stop being orders and your life stops swinging wildly based on temporary weather inside the chest. When you live from enough, you stop accepting crumbs. You stop settling. You stop letting comparison infect your desires, and your choices become cleaner. When you choose authenticity, you stop sending mixed signals to life and to people, and you build a life that actually fits you, not a life designed to win approval. And when you trust timing, you stop poisoning your path with impatience, and you move with urgency without panic, which is one of the rarest forms of strength. If you want one clean takeaway to carry with you, let it be this. Stoicism doesn't promise you that everything will come to you. It teaches you how to stop pushing everything away. It teaches you how to remove the inner resistance that turns desire into desperation, effort into franticness, and waiting into suffering. And when you remove that resistance, you become clearer, calmer, and more consistent. And a clear, calm, consistent person tends to build a life that looks magnetic from the outside, because they're not constantly sabotaging themselves from the inside. So here's a quiet invitation you can try today. Pick one rule you resisted while listening, the one that made you feel slightly exposed, and practice it once in the next 24 hours in a real situation, not in your imagination. Hold desire lightly Return to the present. Accept the friction. Choose your response. Wait without forcing. Notice what you already have. Let emotions rise without obeying them. Decide what is enough. Speak from truth. Keep working while time does its part. And then watch how your life begins to shift. Not like a miracle, but like a machine finally running without sand in the gears.